Afternoon, everybody. Thank you, Laura, for that great introduction, and I want to thank all of you for having me today. I try not to get too personal when I give presentations, but today I want to start with two very quick confessions. The first is, as Laura just said, I'm not Vicky Arroyo. So for those of you who are coming to see her, I apologize, but I will do my best to channel her energy and passion for all things climate change. My second confession is that I'm a lawyer. Now, what that means is I'm not a nurse, I'm not an epidemiologist, I'm not a public health practitioner of any kind, at least in the traditional sense. So, what I'm going to talk about today is not data, is not science, is not any of those kinds of things. I'm going to talk about action. I'm going to talk about what the states in particular and localities are doing to adapt to the public health impacts of climate change. So try to start broad, and then my colleagues here are going to try to fill in what that really looks like on the ground as we go through. So without further ado, I have no conflicts that I know of. I'm going to start today, since I'm going first, with a quick overview of what the projected impacts of climate change on the public health look like, to try to provide some context for what things the states and localities and the federal government are actually trying to do, well, what problems they're trying to address. Second, I'm going to spend the bulk of my time in the second part, looking at, from both a planning perspective and an implementation perspective, what states and localities are doing to combat public health impacts of climate change. And third, I know John's going to be talking about a lot of the national stuff, but I'm going to take a very quick moment to just talk about the state-specific pieces in the federal bills. And then we'll wrap up. So without further ado, the IPCC in 2007 put out a report that probably most of you have seen already, looking at current impacts of climate change and projected. And for North America, I've pulled out several of the ones that are most relevant to the public's health. Things like decreased water availability, increased wildfires, more frequent and intense heat waves, flooding in coastal areas, and I'll talk a little bit about that, how that impacts the public health shortly, and spread of infectious diseases, waterborne, foodborne, and vectorborne. So let's start with heat. This is the thing people most often think of with climate change, right? It's going to get hot. So this graphic here that you see from the U.S. Global Climate Change Research Program, from this year, shows a comparison between the number of days with peak temperature over 90 degrees Fahrenheit in the years 1961 to 1979, and then the projections for late this century. And you can see from the colors, pretty obviously it's a big change. I want to point out how much of a change we're talking about. If you take a look at North Florida, in the 60s and 70s, they were averaging about 60 days a year or so with peak temperatures over 90. The projection for later this century is 165 days per year, which comes out to maybe 5.5 months or so. This is a pretty stunning and dramatic increase. And for those of you who care, this is under a higher emissions, not a lower emissions scenario for the right side. Now, this isn't going to have the same impacts on everybody, right? There are particular populations who are most vulnerable to heat, and those include infants, the elderly, and people with chronic respiratory conditions who will be most impacted. I also want to frame this in terms of, we're talking about an already somewhat overburdened public health system that's going to have to deal with a pretty significant increase in doing the things that the public health system already sometimes struggles to do with the resources it has. So mortality, clearly the most dramatic of the health-related impacts of heat. And if you take a look at this map, which is from the EPA's Excessive Heat Events Guidebook, you can see that the most dramatic impact is going to be most likely in the Midwest and Northeastern urban areas. Now, think also about the fact that these are areas where it's not only going to be much, much hotter than it is usually. People aren't acclimated to it being that hot as often. And the physical structures in those places are not designed and built with sort of resistance and adaptation to heat in mind. So we're talking about a pretty significant, even indoor, heat problem. Ground level ozone, another potential public health impact, otherwise known as smog. You can see here the difference between, well, these are both projections, under a lower emission scenario and a higher emission scenario, also from USGCRP and also for the 2090s. And you can see either way a pretty significant increase in ground level ozone, which can lead to problems with respiratory conditions also. The most vulnerable populations are those suffering from bronchitis, asthma, other sort of chronic conditions that make it already difficult for them to breathe. But even healthy people can suffer pretty severe public health impacts from ground level ozone. Things like irritation of eyes, nose, and mouth and lungs, difficulty breathing, chest pain, coughing and wheezing. Not a pretty picture all around. I want to talk about infectious disease very briefly also. This map from NRDC, you can see the red zones here are counties as of 2005 who are reporting positive for not dengue, but the mosquito species that can be a vector for dengue. And the blue sections are counties that are vulnerable for it. Now, those of you who know something about climate change and public health may be wondering why I chose dengue as an example for sort of infectious disease. It's, you know, not something we have a whole lot of here. It's something that you need the mosquito vector to transmit. It's extraordinarily difficult to sort of predict what the impact is going to be for dengue with a lot of confounding variables. There are other infectious diseases, both food and waterborne, that are sort of much easier to predict what's going to happen. Things like Giardia, Cryptosporidium, Salmonella will all have impacts as well, and they're much more certain. The reason I wanted to talk about dengue as sort of an example is to also play up the fact that factors like heat, humidity, changes in precipitation, the sort of municipal infrastructure that exists in each of these places are going to all interplay with vulnerability to dengue. And that's something that the public health system is going to have to deal with. And so I wanted to, in some ways, pick sort of a weird example and talk about how hard it is to predict in some ways. But regardless, we're going to have to be prepared to act. Sea level rise. You've got Manhattan and a little bit of the rest of New York City right here. My apologies, I'm not a Northeasterner, so my New York geography is kind of bad. You can see the blue on this map is projected inundation zone estimates if sea level stays exactly the same as it is now. The light pink, which you don't see too much of, is projected areas that would be inundated with a 13.8-inch sea level rise. And the darker, sort of orangey pink, is areas that would be inundated with a 16.7-inch sea level rise. And the little green dots and squares that you see are water pollution control plants and pump stations. Now, I don't think you have to use too much imagination to think about what would happen if wastewater treatment plants get inundated by the ocean. Also not so pretty. Other public health impacts of sea level rise include things like saltwater intrusion into freshwater drinking supplies, loss of wetlands that currently filter some wastes from water, and greater storm surges and things like that would also threaten the critical infrastructure that is right along the coast. Before I move on to what the states are doing, I do want to say that I have not certainly covered an exhaustive list of public health impacts. I haven't talked about extreme weather events like hurricanes and tornadoes and all that kind of stuff, because I wanted to sort of reinforce the idea also that climate change is not necessarily a catastrophic big picture thing. It is also sort of a chronic day-to-day change. And that really, I think, impacts the way that we think about what to do about it. So, definitions. This is from UN Foundation Scientific Expert Group report. There are two things that you can do, sort of thinking about climate change and what we do next. The first is mitigation, which means reducing the emissions that we put out in the atmosphere now to try to lessen, you know, the actual warming that will take place. The second is acknowledging that even if we stopped emitting 100% right this minute, we've still put all kinds of greenhouse gases out into the atmosphere, and they're going to stick around for a while. So we have to think about not only how we reduce our emissions, but what we're going to do in the meantime with the ones that we've already put out there. And that's adaptation. So we want to talk about preparing for it, increasing community resiliency, and protecting vulnerable populations. So what are the states doing? Oh, and I also wanted to say briefly, I'm sorry, that I don't want you to think of mitigation and adaptation as mutually exclusive from one another, even though I present them as different things. There are all kinds of strategies that you're going to see throughout what the states and localities are doing that certainly have co-benefits for both. And so you can think of them, in a lot of cases, as almost mutually reinforcing, but separate purposes sometimes. So what are the states doing? We've got 12 states right now that have either started or completed statewide adaptation plans, and they cover everything from ecosystems to forests to water to coastal to public health. And I'll put up a chart in just a minute of a couple of them and sort of the things that they cover. The lighter blue states that you see here are states that have got climate action plans generally, usually sort of emissions mitigation focused, and that recommend an adaptation plan for that state, but it hasn't quite happened yet. I also want to give a little shout out to Connecticut, which has got a task force going now, which is putting together recommendations to its legislature to put together an adaptation plan. So they're sort of a half step behind, but they're moving. And another little shout out to South Carolina, which released its coastal adaptation strategy last week. You can see here, this is non-exhaustive again, but the range of things that some of the statewide adaptation plans cover, and you can see that everybody is talking about human or public health. And even, as you'll also see, throughout the other categories, the public health system is really interwoven in a lot of other things that's going on. So let's start with California. California is my planning example. I'm going to talk about some implementation examples too. California has, in my opinion, the most sort of comprehensive, broad-ranging adaptation strategy so far. Started off last November when Governor Schwarzenegger signed an executive order directing all of the state agencies to start planning for sea level rise and other climate impacts. So the agencies all went through their processes, and this past June released a draft strategy. Covers, as you can see, 7 different sectors. It's pretty comprehensive. And was designed to assess the impacts on California, the economy, the health, the ecosystems, you name it. Identify where California was most vulnerable and try to come up with a plan for action. Public comment period just ended. They did hearings all over the place. They took a lot of comments in writing. I actually don't know when the final is going to be released, but I would guess sometime in the new year. And let's talk a little bit about what the public health strategies themselves were. California, in impacts, was looking mostly for the public health sector at extreme heat events, decreases in air quality, changes in precipitation, so floods, drought, wildfires, you name it, sea level rise, and infectious diseases. And sort of coming from that, they came up with a list of 10 total strategies to try to adapt to those particular impacts. And I've only listed a couple of them here. There are a few sort of overarching ones that I didn't include that sound sort of like educating, you know, citizens and businesses and organizations on what they can do, which is fantastic, coordinating better sort of among agencies, also very important, and conducting further research to figure out what might work better than what they come up with first. All sort of logical. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the more specifically substantive ones today. So the first, promote community resilience. Now, what exactly does that mean? It's the idea that if the community itself is healthier to start with, it will be better able to adapt to coming stresses. So, improving the existing infrastructure to combat things like chronic diseases, obesity, and thinking about that in a very broad way. Even encompassing things like land use policy, transportation policy, really trying to think broadly about what different sort of inputs and entry points you can find to impact the public's health. Ability to walk and bike, expanded access to medical care, sort of on the back end, knowing that some of this is coming. The second, promoting strategies with co-benefits, looks somewhat similar, but a little bit different. It's promoting things like smart growth, for example. So you're going to promote smart growth, which will get people driving less, using more public transportation, walking more, which will reduce emissions and, at least in theory and hopefully in practice, reduce obesity levels, make people healthier. It's got sort of a win-win on both sides. The other thing under this that I think is really interesting is that they're talking about instituting health impact assessments, which I assume would be somewhat different, or somewhat similar rather, to environmental impact assessments. So every policy under the transportation department, every policy under the land use department or the housing department would be evaluated for its health impact. In terms of surveillance, it's some of the things that you might think. It's increasing capacity to not only monitor climate-related illnesses, but to do it well and do it quickly in response to potentially sort of fast-changing things. Developing locals' capacity to conduct better surveillance as well, to improve existing electronic health records and set up a health information exchange so that information can be quickly gathered, compared, shared, etc. in the event of an outbreak of some kind, or even some of these more sort of slow, chronic conditions, to monitor them over time and see if the strategies are working. And last, public health preparedness. This is sort of the quintessential public health intervention. Trying to, again, sort of enhance capacity, both at the state and local level, to respond quickly and respond well. I'm going to do a quick few implementation examples, very quick. Chicago is both talking about mitigation and adaptation. I'm going to focus on their adaptation work for today. They are, interestingly, focusing mostly on heat in their early work, although some with water management and some other things. First, updating their emergency response planning, so setting up better early warning systems, cooling centers, educating the public and providers about what to do in the event of, you know, a heat wave, and partnering both with hospitals and community organizations in trying to set these systems up. And that's sort of the back end, thinking about, you know, these heat waves are coming, what are we going to do about it when they get here? Interestingly, and I think this is something that's happening elsewhere, but Chicago's laid it out very clearly, they're also talking about planning sort of for the front end. So things like installing reflective and cool roofs to keep the inside of buildings cooler in the first place. So you would need fewer interventions if you manage to keep people actually cooler inside, especially at night, since nights are going to be warmer as well, to sort of reduce those indoor temperatures. Second, increasing the urban forest canopy. They're planting tons of trees. Again, keep the buildings cooler in the first place. And mapping urban heat islands, so pockets within the city that, because of concentrations of concrete and other things, just get much, much hotter than other areas of the city. And by being able to map that, to really be able to put together an effective targeted strategy, thinking about who is most vulnerable, where are they, and what can we do first. It's probably worth noting that only one of the things on this list are really traditional public health agency kinds of things, and are being carried out by the Zoning Commission and Department of Environmental Protection and the housing agency and all kinds of sort of partners that are making this possible. I want to show a quick picture. This is the roof of City Hall, which they planned with shrubs and trees and other plants, vegetation. And you can see the sort of dark area in the purple and yellow picture. The purple is obviously much, much cooler than the yellow. The purple is the top of City Hall, and the yellow is the top of the county building next door, where they did not put any vegetation, and there's roughly a 70 degree temperature difference on the roof between the two. I'll let you draw your own conclusions from that. But it's working. So the plan is to retrofit 6,000 residential properties this year, increasing to 60,000 per year by 2018, and 400,000 total by about 2020. I'm going to skip over my Maryland example because I'm behind. But you should know that they're integrating, their first phase is sea level rise, but they're integrating public health even into that phase. And you should know that they're doing sort of a gap analysis of whether the public health system is ready to protect drinking water supply, wastewater treatment, and infectious disease breakouts. New York City, I'm going to show you my, oh no, I showed you my pretty picture already. So sea level rise and water wastewater treatment, again, not sort of traditional public health agency kind of stuff, but one with enormous public health impacts. So they're talking about moving some critical facilities, reinforcing others, making sure that everybody's got safe water to drink. I'm gonna skip this altogether because John's gonna talk about federal stuff. So, what's my take-home message for you? You can do this. People are doing this, and you can do it. If you live in a state that's got a statewide adaptation plan already, that's fantastic. That means not only do you have a framework to work within, but you've also got, you know, theoretically at least, sort of state-level leadership that's going to support you doing it in some way. If you don't, though, I do want to say, I mean, Chicago is doing this. Illinois doesn't have a plan. Milwaukee is doing interesting stuff. Wisconsin doesn't have a plan. Delaware is doing all kinds of cool coastal stuff. They don't have a plan. So there's no reason that you can't. Second, I want you to remember to think broadly and think about what partner agencies can really reinforce the work that you do, because I don't think public health agencies can do this well alone. And third, learn from others who are already doing this, who may be a half step ahead. There's no reason to reinvent the wheel, so use the models that are out there and seem maybe to be working. There's a more full list. I do have to plug the website for Vicky. There's a more full list of adaptation plans and what's going on the Georgetown Climate website, so please check it out. Thank you very much.